Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert. And every single week, we are bringing you discussions about movies and the history behind them. And this week is a special week. We're kicking off the new year, kicking off the first podcast of 2024 from California, where San Francisco is hosting the American Historical Association's annual conference. If you're not familiar with this, this is probably the largest conference of historians in the world where we all get together and talk about a whole slew of different things. And we're all coming to San Francisco this year. And if you drive down from San Francisco to a town called Half Moon Bay, and you look out over the water, you're going to see one of the world's great surf breaks. One of the world's great big wave surf breaks, actually, in a place called Mavericks. So I thought this week would be a really cool week to talk about a film a lot of us love, 1991's Point Break, starring Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves, directed by Catherine Bigelow. And I wanted to pair that with an amazing scholar. So I got Scott Latterman, who is professor of history at the University of Minnesota Duluth and a surfer himself, to come on and talk about not only Point Break, but also his 2014 book, Empire and Waves, A Political History of Surfing. And we're going to talk not only about this film, but we're also going to talk about his work in this book, where we talk about the diaspora of surfing, its commodification, the commercialization of the sport. We're going to talk about how surfers respond to genocide and apartheid in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. We're going to talk about how surfers view surfing in film and the biggest and best surfing movies of all time. And of course, we're going to talk about the greatest surfers themselves, folks like Duke Kahanamoku, Laird Hamilton, Kelly Slater, and many others. So this was an awesome conversation. I really enjoyed sitting back and talking to Scott about this. I hope that you really enjoy this conversation. So it's time to paddle out to the lineup, if you will, because Point Break is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Scott Latterman, how are you, man?
I'm doing really well. It's great to be here with you.
Dude, I am so excited to have you on. I've been circling this movie for the longest time on this podcast. Frankly, I've been circling your book for the longest time. I got your book. Oh, gosh, man. It was back when the Western History Association was actually in Minneapolis, St. Paul. This would have been like 2015, 2016, somewhere in that range. And I remember getting your book, like University of California Press, which is one of my favorite presses, had your book. And this is like, I was like, can I have that? Because I was a poor graduate student. And they were like, yeah, absolutely. So I got the book and it did the thing. And I'm going to tell this to you right now. Like, it did the thing where you get the book and then it just kind of sits on your shelf for a while. Like, I had it next to like the rest of my surf books and my fishing books and stuff like that. And I kept meaning to read it. And I was like, I have to read this damn book. And then I finally read it. And I was like, oh my God, I just love this book. So I hope you're not embarrassed. I absolutely love this book. I'm going to tell everybody that I've been telling people how much I love this book. I think it's amazing for people who have not. This is such a cool thing you wrote. I don't know if you get many calls to like talk about a book you wrote, what, maybe a decade ago? I mean, how long did it take you to write this?
I worked on it for a few years. But, you know, researching a book on surfing, it's work, sure, but it's different sort of work. There's a lot of pleasure in that work, in that research. You know, I got to go to Australia, to Hawaii. I spent a lot of time in California, which is where I'm from. It was not a rough gig at all. So I spent a few years working on it, but these were very happy years.
Yeah, like how you get to like take pictures of the archive. Like, so for instance, I kept trying to figure out when I was actually looking at the cover of your book. I thought at first I was like, okay, dudes in wetsuits or something like this. I was like, oh, they're clearly going out to Mavericks. I thought for a certain year at Half Moon Bay, something like that. And then I'd find out, you know, I look in the covers like you're surfing. Is this up in Duluth, the cover of this book?
It is. Yeah, that's not sand we're walking through, that's snow.
Is that really?
It is, yeah.
Is that like a 5? Is that a 7 millimeter? Like what's the wetsuit you're wearing on something like that?
Yeah, it's a 6 mil suit. So yeah, surfing in you know, I grew up in Southern California, right. And then I made the move after high school to Northern California, which I thought was really cold. I also spent a year on the South Island, New Zealand, where I surfed in snow for the first time. And I thought that was cold, but nothing prepared me for what I've learned to experience in Duluth, which is cold on an entirely different sort of level. our surf season here does not correspond with the nicest weather that we get, which is the summers here, which are really delightful. Now, surf season starts in the fall, ends in the spring. January, February are sort of peak months, and those are damn cold months here in northern Minnesota.
Is that just because you're dependent upon the are you getting a northern wind to make the breaks, or what is it you've got there?
Yeah, northeast wind is what we rely on. In an ideal world, you get a strong northeast blowing up on the eastern part of Lake Superior with a northwest wind locally here in Duluth, which gives us a nice offshore wind. Sometimes that happens. Things come together really well. Oftentimes you're just surfing in onshore slop that, well, you know, there are waves and you're on a lake in Minnesota, so you take it.
I think people are going to be surprised when they read the book to know that there's actually surfing in Minnesota. And I think they surf up in Wisconsin as well. I guess you can surf all the Great Lakes. That would be my guess. I mean, wherever you can get a wave.
You can.
Right?
It's true. Though, you know, I think we're very proud in Duluth. It always sounds silly when I say this, but I think we get the best surf in the Midwest here in Duluth.
You're just going to upset some people in Iowa who are like, wait a second, we've... Okay, yeah, definitely. So, and of course, the book we're talking about is this book you wrote. It came out in, 2014, was it? Empire That's right. and Waves. Yes. It's a political history of surfing, which is what, drug me in. I was like, what is this, right? I will get into this as we're talking about this film that we're talking about today, Point Break, for anyone who did not actually look at the title of the episode before we jump in. But I'm just so excited to talk to you about this. So before we jump into this movie and your book and your work and so forth, maybe we can just introduce yourself and tell us about who you are and what you do and kind of go from there.
Sure. So I teach history at the University of Minnesota Duluth. It was, in fact, my interest in graduate school and history in particular that brought me out to Minnesota from California. I was born and raised in California, but it was graduate school that brought me to the Twin Cities. I was a PhD student at the Twin Cities campus, not in the history department there, but in the American Studies program, though I worked with historians. You know, my assumption coming out from California, it was fairly typical California snob. Why would you ever spend time in the Midwest? Is that I would come out, do my coursework over 2 or 3 years, and then I get the hell out of Minnesota back to California. And I got here, and I actually really quite liked it. It's a nice area. I did feel landlocked, though, you know, when I make my way up to Lake Superior, that helped a lot. And then when I finished my PhD, you're looking for a job. I got a job offer at UMD, the University of Minnesota Duluth. And I remember thinking, you know, as a grad student, when I come up through the area, well, it's a really nice area. I could, you know, live here someday. Never actually thinking I would. And so when the job offer came, I was delighted to be able to accept it. And so I've been here since 2005 in Duluth. And I can say I have really no intention of leaving. I mean, it's a beautiful area. If you love the outdoors, it's a great place to be. And frankly, there aren't many places as a surfer where you can afford to own a home unless you're a tech billionaire. And I can do that in Duluth. So I'm here.
So, you know, I obviously went to Minnesota as well. And, you know, you get the weekends, and I would grow out to the St. Croix River a lot of times and just chill out over there. And on occasion, we'd zip up to Duluth as well. And I always dug Duluth. Like, you're on that south shore of Superior. It's real. Like, the town kind of wraps around the lake, and it's gorgeous.
It is. It's a cool town.
It's a cool town. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to conceptualize just how goddamn big that lake is. I mean, it's Lake Superior. We know the Edmund Fitzgerald, but it's just this inland sea that just goes on and on. It's hard to conceptualize. And then in the winter, it's frightening to me, at least, but you're out there surfing the whole time.
When we can. Yeah, it is. I mean, it, you know, probably isn't the smartest thing to do, but you know, when you're a Californian stuck in the Midwest, you take what you can get. And to be perfectly honest, I in many ways enjoy surfing here more than I enjoy surfing in California now. I mean, California, I'll go out there to visit my family. I'm not usually that tempted to get out in the water. It's, you know, beaches are packed. You know, everybody's giving stink eye at everyone else out in the water. It's just not usually a very fun experience. And here in Duluth, you know, I mean, the water's clear, it's clean. People are friendly out there. You usually know most of the people around you, and it's a beautiful setting. It's just, it's really quite pleasant. It's cold though.
Well, I guess maybe it's kind of the almost like the Tao of surfing, right? That you're just going to make it work. You know, you're going to take what you're given and do it anyway. You know, and I'm certainly not a big surfer. I paddleboard. I've surfed a little bit. I'm really better at falling off and being chum for sharks. In Florida, you know, we've got these bull sharks just everywhere in Florida. I don't know if you've got bull sharks in California. I would assume not so much in Minnesota. But God, they are pain in the ass. I do not like California, bull sharks, at all.
I hear you. Those things freak me out. I've spent some time in Central America where there's sometimes a concern. I take students every couple of years to Central America on these surfing-based study abroad programs. And we went one year to Nicaragua. And I remember on Lake Nicaragua, there were bull sharks there. And yeah, those things, they freak me out. They're quite vicious. Yeah, we don't have those in California. And happily, we don't have those in Minnesota. We had a mayor here in Duluth some years ago who ran on a platform of keeping Duluth shark-free, and he succeeded.
That's awesome. It's like if the worst thing you have to worry about are like musk a lunge, I guess you're okay. You know, it's like right. We'll be okay. You know, maybe you've got ravenous Wisconsinites that cross the border or something like that. But it's, you know, if you're not having to worry about sharks, no jellyfish either. I can't stand jellyfish. I love Florida, and then I start talking about it. I'm like, what exactly do I love about Florida? Because I'm like, sharks, jellyfish, you know, you've got crocodiles and alligators and pythons, just everything in the water wants to – it's America's Australia, which you've surfed, I'm assuming. So, and we'll get into Australia with this film as well. And, you know, traditionally, whenever I ask people to come on the podcast, I usually just, you know, kind of go to people like, hey, do you want to do a thing? But I kind of came to you to ask you specifically about this film because there just aren't that many scholars of surfing, I found. Or have you, or is there a larger surfing sub-scholarly subculture that I am unaware of?
There is a growing number of scholars who are doing work on surfing. Very few of them are historians. There are, you know, a handful of us out there. A lot of people who do work on surf tourism from a social scientific perspective in particular, tourism studies sort of work. It's still a fairly small community of people. We often know each other. There are, like I said, a growing number of historians who are taking up this issue. But it is still, you know, you can count the number on probably, well, maybe not one hand, but probably two.
I'm kind of wondering, okay, so I came to you to do Point Break. Is this a film you had kind of grown up with? Were you familiar with this film before? Like, where does Point Break sit in the mind of contemporary surf culture? Is this in the pantheon of surf films? Like, what is this movie we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, I mean, sure, everybody knew it growing up, right? You know, Hollywood would make these, you know, occasional attempts to try to either capture surfing and, you know, the magic of surfing. I mean, Gidget, you know, was the first in the late 1950s, widely scorned by surfers, however. And there were efforts, you know, in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, early 90s, we get to Point Break. I think most surfers probably weren't thrilled with this film. Surfers tend to be pretty critical of Hollywood treatments of surfing. I have a bit of a soft spot for it. And, you know, I do appreciate a number of things about it. It's about surfing, but it's also not necessarily a surfing film, you know, not in the same way that, say, you know, Gidget or Big Wednesday or North Shore would be surfing films. I mean, this is a film about a group of surfers and, of course, Keanu Reeves trying to break into this group of surfers. But it's also bigger than that. And I think it's also important, too. I mean, this is, you know, Kathryn Bigelow made this film, who at the time, you know, wasn't a huge name. But I mean, since then, she's become a significant figure in Hollywood. Zero Dark Thirty, The Hurt Locker. It's weird for me to think about that transition from a film like Point Break to those. But nevertheless, you know, it was Kathryn Bigelow who brought this to us.
Yeah, you know, with Bigelow herself too, right? Like you could, she's always been such a great action director. She does these great things with these low shots and these kind of handheld cams, and you kind of feel like, you know, even like in the scene, like when Johnny Utah gets like decked when he's in the lineup and he's dropping in on guys, you know, you feel like you're alongside. She does such a cool thing with the kind of feeling as best you can, like. This is before you could strap a YouTube or a GoPro onto a board, it feels like you're in there at times.
Oh yeah. Effective camera work. It's and it does accurately capture, I think, a number of things that surfers were thinking about in the early 90s. I mean, like I said, it's sort of about surfing, but sort of not. But, you know, this character of Bodie, played by Patrick Swayze, is seen as, in some ways, the sole surfer that was being discussed in the 1980s, particularly in thinking about a film like North Shore, which was not a huge commercial success, but has become something of a cult favorite among surfers. You know, at a time when surfing was becoming more and more corporatized, you know, the surf industry had built up and developed. Patrick Swayze is the guy who surfs because of this deep love for surfing. And of course, he undertakes a number of illegal actions in order to subsidize that surfing habit. You know, that's at the heart of Point Break. But in some ways, you know, he had a personality that surfers could identify with. You know, he surfed for what surfers, I think, would say is the purity of this pastime. You know, it was about a person and a wave, trying to harness that energy, capture that energy, and embrace, you know, what surfers often talk about is that spiritual experience that's associated with the act of wave riding.
Yeah. In fact, they do it like in this film, they do a, you know, Bodie talks specifically about, like, there's that other group that they get in a fight with, the other group of surfers that they get in a fight with on the beach with Warchild, and Anthony Kiedis is in this film, you know, who are almost like, they feel like Santa Cruz-ish kind of like surfers to me. Whenever I'm looking at them, I'm like, are these dudes from Santa Cruz? Is that what, are they down here? And people who don't know what I'm talking about, just hang tight. We'll get into like the localities of surfing and stuff like that. But I mean, that was kind of the feeling I get, was like very real, drawing the lines. Like, this was not about the rush. This was about being into the moment. And that's the reason why you could relate to our arch villain, you know, and you know, towards the end of the film, you're kind of hoping he gets away, you know, at the end, because you really do kind of empathize with this dude who is robbing banks and holding up women and all these other heinous acts of, you know, violence and so forth. Right.
Yeah, it's hard not to partially identify with him. He's a scumbag on a number of levels, but he's, you know, also a sympathetic and almost even lovable scumbag at times, you know, and is also, you know, I mean, for someone who talks a lot about nonviolence and sort of spirituality, he's also someone we see who has no problem engaging in violence, you know, and he dismisses it at one point at the end. He says, you know, this is why I can't remember the name of the character, but, you know, the guy who I keep close who does this sort of stuff for me. But Patrick Swayze, he's in there doing it too. But again, like many, you know, scumbags in Hollywood films, we do learn to identify with them on a number of levels.
You know, also, this is 91. This is peak Swayze, right? I mean, this is almost Dalton from Roadhouse going bad and getting a surfboard, is what it feels like. You know, as far as that level of just kind of zen kind of dudes. Like, what happens if Dalton grew up in California and went to surfing and skydiving and all this kind of stuff? Well, he's coming off a slew of movies, off of Red Dawn, off of Roadhouse. I can't recall if Ghost is before or after this film, but it's right in there.
Dirty Dancing was in there somewhere too.
Dirty Dancing, I think 87.
Yeah.
He is killing it. And he kind of, you know, he almost serves as that like perfect mentor figure for Keanu. I mean, it's just like Keanu's our entry into this world. Swayze's amazing in this film. I love him. He looks like he's got that surfer's body, that kind of aquiline kind of body that I do not have whatsoever, which is why he can stay on a board. And I don't think he had ever actually surfed before making this film, if I recall correctly. I don't think neither him nor Keanu Reeves. I think I remember reading that Lori Petty had never even been in the ocean before making this film.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they all had to learn. And surfing's not an intuitive thing if you've never, you know, there's that scene early on, or whenever Keanu's talking to the kid at the surf store, and the guy's like, hey, he's like, you're not too old to start riding. He's like, I'm 24 or 26 or whatever. He's like, yeah. You know, it's like at that point in time, if you're not on a board by the time you're three, you're done. You know, it just feels like. So before we get into what we like and what we don't like, start picking this film apart, for people who are not as familiar with surfing, and I'm hesitant to even, Scott, I'm hesitant to even call it a sport at times, because sport almost kind of feels antithetical to what my understanding of what surf is, but maybe we could introduce our audience a little bit to what surfing is, like maybe where it comes from historically. And then I also want to get into like your book where we talk about how it, you know, there's really like this surf diaspora that kind of emerges from Hawaii and other places, spurred on largely by the United States, you know, in your book. But let's kind of go back to the basics. Like, what is surfing? Where does it come from? When does it kind of evolve, create? How do we know it as this pastime now? Where is surfing from?
Yeah, it's a good question. Modern surfing, what we know today as surfing, really has its origins in the Polynesian world, and in particular in Hawaii. It wasn't exclusively Hawaii, but stand-up surfing really, you know, draws from this Hawaiian tradition. Hawaii, it had been done for, well, you know, for ages. When people started arriving, outsiders started arriving in the Hawaiian Islands, they recorded this experience of witnessing surfing, which was completely foreign to them. These weren't actually, however, the first recorded accounts of people witnessing surfing, at least if we think about surfing more broadly, is not just standing up on a board, but riding waves for pleasure. There's a historian at the University of California, Merced, Kevin Dawson, an excellent historian who's done work on the history of these wave riding traditions off the coast of West Africa. And there are accounts recorded from West Africa of explorers there who witness West Africans riding waves. And this draws from a long tradition of West Africans as water people, something that then ended up being exploited by white enslavers during the slave trade. But today, modern surfing, as we know it, really does have its roots in Hawaii. And in the 19th century, of course, this was a pivotal century in the Hawaiian Islands. Cook arrived in the late 18th century, but in the 19th century, Hawaii becomes subject to exploitation by outsiders. And it's in the 19th century that the Hawaiian monarchy comes to an end and the United States colonizes the islands. But this was a long process. You know, in 1820, American missionaries arrive. They, together with other outsiders, bring with them foreign pathogens that end up just decimating the Hawaiian population. I mean, there's a demographic tragedy in the islands where greater than 90% of the Hawaiian people die by the end of the 19th century. This, you know, leads outsiders to have much less difficult of a time in exploiting the islands, so that by 1893, there's a coup that overthrows the monarchy led by American business interests. 5 years later, the United States annexes the Hawaiian Islands, effectively colonizing Hawaii in an act of appropriation that, you know, was unconstitutional even by the standards of that day. And this begins then a new phase in Hawaiian life. Now, Hawaiians continued to surf throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century. But one of the things that we see in the early 20th century is the growing number of white Americans arriving in the islands and adopting surfing as a pastime of their own, having been taught by, it's important to note, native Hawaiian surfers. Two of the most notable are Duke Hanamoku, who, you know, is a very storied figure in surfing history, and then George Freeth, who also is a tremendously important figure in Hawaiian surfing history, as well as in the history of California surfing. It was Freeth that really planted the seeds for California's surf culture, having come to California, moved there in the early 20th century. These are folks who taught, you know, these early Haoles to arrive in Hawaii how to surf. One especially notable figure was a South Carolinian by the name of Alexander Hume Ford, who became one of the biggest boosters in the Hawaiian Islands of Hawaii. Ford, he was a racist. You know, he was someone who, you know, welcomed the American presence in the islands, and in fact wanted to see Hawaii transformed into, you know, an American stronghold and outpost in the mid-Pacific region, a place from which the United States could assert its power and dominance in Asia and elsewhere in the Pacific region. And Ford, at the same time, became a major proponent of surfing. He learned to surf early on, He got stoked and started publishing, in fact, a magazine called Mid-Pacific Magazine, which served as a vehicle to boost and promote Hawaii in, you know, the early 20th century world, but also featured surfing at its center. In fact, the cover of the first issue of Mid-Pacific Magazine was a photograph of Duke Hanamoku surfing in Hawaii. And so, you know, Ford was someone who took this on. He founded the Outrigger Canoe Club, which became a storied institution in Waikiki. You know, someone who, again, played a really important and pivotal role there, but also tried to, in some ways, rewrite history in a way that suggested that Hawaiians had died off. And it was thanks to folks like Alexander Hume Ford that surfing was resurrected in the early 20th century. And that's just simply not true. And so modern surfing, as we know it, has its roots in Hawaii, but you know, ultimately underwent a process of globalization so that it emerged in California and elsewhere in the United States, in Australia and South Africa, so that today, you know, anywhere you find a large body of water, you're likely to find surfers.
One of the things I kept thinking about in this particular film as I'm watching it is just how we get to where we are in 1991, like where surfing is in 1991, where it is now. Now it's, I would imagine it's even bigger. The culture has grown. You could actually say names other than Kelly Slater that people will probably recognize. And I do want to kind of get into maybe some of these luminary guys like Duke. I want to come back and talk about Duke in a moment because I think he's a super important guy. I believe there's a film coming out that's going to be made on him starring Jason Momoa as Duke. I don't know how they're going to pull that off because Momoa is just a beast of a man, and Duke was kind of slender. But, you know, there are worse things in the world than to have a Duke Hanamoku biopic. I mean, I'm in, but I want to get to him in a second. You talked a little bit about Gidget a little bit earlier, and you talked about the wariness of surfers about the way it's been portrayed in film, at least up until, say, 91. Can you talk a little bit about, like, where that happens? Because everything kind of happens pre and post Gidget, right? But can we talk a little bit about like surf in film up until that point? Because that's a real part of how surf culture gets exported beyond the islands or into a much larger world. Am I wrong? Like, how does this happen? And how is surf portrayed in film up until this point in time?
You're talking about up until 1991?
Yeah, say up until 91. Up until how does it earn this well-earned distrust by surfers at this point in time? Why are surfers so wary of seeing their thing on screen?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's an interesting question. Surfers have always had mixed feelings, I think, about surf film. On the one hand, surfers love to see themselves on film. On the other hand, it encourages more people to take up surfing, and surfers usually aren't that crazy about that, right? Because surfing, you know, is about people exploiting a very finite resource, waves. There are only so many waves, and you know, as a surfer, you want to find as many waves as you can. They don't come often. By that, I mean, you know, if you're sitting out in the water surfing, you know, it's not wave after wave after wave. You know, you sit there for long periods of time, often really long periods of time, waiting for what we call a set of waves to arrive. And, you know, a set comes maybe 3-4 waves in a set. So 3 or 4 people out in the water catch a wave. But everybody else is just sit there waiting for their opportunity to catch one as well. And so the more people you have in the water, the fewer waves ultimately you're going to get. And so surfers often aren't crazy about these Hollywood films, not only because they feel they misrepresent what surfing is, but often because they have the effect of encouraging people to take up surfing. And that just means more competition in the water. But going back to your question about how we get up to, you know, 1991, up to Point Break and film, Gidget was really Hollywood's first attempt to take a crack at surf culture. And this is ironic, I think. You know, it's a film about a young woman trying to break into the man's world of surfing in Malibu. This is at a time when very few women were surfing. Women surfed widely in Hawaii up through the end of the 19th century. Surfing was done, you know, equally by men and women. In fact, many of the, you know, the traditional mele, the chants that have been passed down through oral tradition feature women surfers at their center. But as the United States colonized the Hawaiian Islands and the United States was, you know, riven with sexism, well, sexism made its way into surf culture and women became, it was very difficult for for women to find opportunities in the water. Not only because it was seen as unfeminine in American society, but there were also structural barriers to doing so. Boards at the time were massive and heavy. And, you know, if you weren't, you know, a big, bulky, strong male, they could be very difficult just to simply transport to get in the water. As things like board technology progressed, hollow surfboards, lighter wood materials, and ultimately after World War II, we get into synthetic materials like polyurethane and polystyrene foam, they become lighter and surfing becomes more accessible. And so, you know, that period shortly after World War II sees a massive growth in the number of surfers at the same time that it sees a massive growth in the American middle class. You know, this enabled the growth of surf culture, both because surfing technology drew on some of these World War II technologies with things like board creation, surf forecasting, the development of wetsuits, and so on, but also because that economic explosion that led to the growth, at least among white Americans, or especially among white Americans, I should say, of the middle class, enabled people additional opportunities to seek leisure and also put more Americans in places like Southern California. The growth of the aerospace industry in Southern California, for example, meant a number of young engineers moving to the area who had families and their kids were heading off to the beach to take up surfing. And so we see in the late 1940s into the 1950s a growth in the number of surfers. Gidget comes out in 1959, helps to popularize the sport of surfing. And again, like you, I'm often reluctant to use that term sport because surfers will often argue surfing's not a sport, it's a pastime, it's a way of life. You know, we don't have to get into that here. But nevertheless, surfing popularizes in part because of Gidget, but it was already popularizing even before then. Surfers aren't crazy about this movie, you know, for a number of different reasons. They feel that it's not an accurate representation of what surf culture was like. They didn't like, at least they blamed it for helping to contribute to the crowding of surf breaks in Southern California, especially places like Malibu, though this was happening even before the film came out. And it's also, you know, watching it today, and it's a film I show in a class that I teach, you know, you look at this and it's, you know, these are well, it's, first of all, it's a very hokey film, but also the surf scenes are, you know, clearly someone just standing in front of a green screen, you know, pretending to be surfing as water is being splashed up in their face. I mean, it's not particularly accurate in terms of the footage that appears in the film. You get distant shots of the water and so on. But, you know, surfers tend to gripe about these sorts of things. You know, one of the reasons they don't like a film like Point Break is say, well, he took off on a right and suddenly he was surfing on a left. If you're not a surfer, you may not understand what I'm talking about. But you know, these sorts of details that much of the audience won't catch, surfers do. And it tends to drive them crazy. In the 1960s, you know, surfing continued to appear in a number of Hollywood films. You know, Gidget helped to spawn this beach blanket phenomenon with, you know, Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon films. Kind of the ultimate surf flick also comes out in the 1960s, and that's The Endless Summer, which is a documentary film. It originally was made for surfers and appeared on the surf circuit, you know, playing in high school and civic center auditoriums in California and Australia and so on. But Bruce Brown, who made the film, believed that this could appeal to a wider audience. And I won't get into the whole backstory of this, but ultimately did appear in theaters across the United States and was tremendously successful. Until the Michael Moore era, it was the most commercially successful documentary film of all time. I mean, so successful, in fact, that the State Department announced that the United States was going to show it at the 1967 Moscow Film Festival. Now, in the end, it didn't actually appear, but that's another story. And I could talk about it in the book. You know, people can certainly read about it there. But, you know, an enormously successful film and kind of the classic surf flick. I mean, even today, I think it's probably considered the greatest surf film in history. Perhaps the only great film ever made about surfing. It's got problems. I mean, you know, you watch it today, it's embarrassing in a number of ways. You know, the racism that appears in there is really quite awful. But it is, you know, the great surf flick, nevertheless. There were other attempts at capturing surfing in film in the 1970s, 1980s. John Milius, who was one of the writers of Apocalypse Now, who also was a surfer, made a film called Big Wednesday, which came out in, I think it was the late 1970s, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was the 1980s.
Somewhere
70, I thought it was 78. Yeah, that sounds about right. John Milius, you know, this well-known right-wing Hollywood filmmaker, he would go on to make not just Conan the Barbarian, but Red Dawn, you know, the original one, which is sort of this right-wing anti-communist fantasy from the 1980s. The film that gave us the PG-13 rating, that was John Milius, but also made this film that, you know, was moderately successful at the box office. It became something of a cult classic among surfers, Big Wednesday, about three young men growing up in Malibu, surfing in Malibu, who ultimately are divided over the Vietnam War. But it's surfing that in the end brings them together again. And so, you know, a film that I feel a certain sort of attachment to, even as I see serious problems with the film. In the 1980s, you know, we see things like North Shore, you know, which, again, not huge commercial success, but nevertheless something that became something of a cult favorite for surfers, and in some ways foreshadowed Point Break, you know, at least the character of Bodhi in Point Break. North Shore is all about this tension that exists between competitive surfing and what surfers were calling soul surfing. And this is at a time when surfing had grown, you know, the surf industry had grown into an increasingly lucrative industry with surf travel, surfwear brands, wetsuits, surf shops all over the place, surf films and other forms of media. You know, today surfing is a multi-billion dollar industry, and we see really the origins of this in the 1980s. So that by the time we get to 1991 with Point Break, I mean, Bodhi was ripe for filmic representation. I mean, he was that figure who was trying to restore that deep connection that surfers felt with the ocean, coming out of, you know, the hyper corporatization and industrialization of surfing in the, especially the 1980s.
We're going to have to talk about North Shore some more in a little bit, because I got to talk about Laird Hamilton at some point in time. In this, I don't even know where to go with this, because I'm so torn on how I feel about Laird and all this other stuff. But like, I want to get into like one of the key points of this particular film and kind of go from there, which is that Johnny Utah has got to infiltrate surf culture. He's got to get in and like find his way amongst the locals. And what we see in the film very clearly is that's not easy to do. And I'm kind of hoping maybe you can kind of explain like what surf, what this tribalistic aspect of this locals only kind of thing, like the idea of showing up on someone else's break. Can you get into a little bit about what that's like, about trying to just, not even if you're trying to investigate a slew of bank robberies, but just showing up on a break and being a guy from out of town and just working your way in, there's a pecking order there, right? I mean, just to even be allowed into it. I mean, can we talk a little bit about like really that insular tribalness of surfers is specific to like guarding territory?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really silly phenomenon, but a very real one that surfers refer to as localism. In some ways, local protection of local surfing breaks, and the sense that if you're not from there, and often that means if you didn't grow up there, you don't have the right to surf there. You know, you might be able to paddle out, but don't expect to catch waves. You know, the people who are locals there, who put in their dues, put in their time, are the ones who have the right to catch, you know, certainly the best waves, if not all the waves. There are real problems with this, as you might imagine. You know, there's a very strong class element to this, particularly given that, you know, those who can afford to live by surf breaks are the more well-off elements of American society. Although I should point out, localism is not strictly an American phenomenon. I mean, this is something that transcends American borders. And there's a very strong race element to this as well, given that, you know, wealth and race are very closely correlated, especially in an American context. And so when you have, you know, coastal communities in places like California that are overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly wealthy, localism takes on some really ugly characteristics. It doesn't mean, again, that, you know, other people cannot surf there. First of all, everybody has the right to surf wherever they want. But that localism phenomenon is one that certainly rears its head in very ugly and disturbing ways, you know. And in California, you know, it's actually become a legal matter in some cases. There's a surf break where localism was particularly pronounced on the Palos Verdes Peninsula This is in LA in the South Bay area. The break is called Lunada Bay. And there were locals there who would harass anybody who showed up. You have to walk down a trail to the ocean in order to surf there. And people would have rocks thrown at them. They would be threatened with violence. Their tires would be slashed on their cars and so on. And ultimately, a number of people complained about this to the police, tried to get them to intervene, and ultimately ended up suing some of those who were the local harassers there and emerged victorious in this. And so, you know, it perhaps dented the localism phenomenon, but it still exists as a very real concern.
I mean, we see this very real in the full-on fist fight right there on the beach, you know, in the film. I felt like that was just, it just felt, from what I've seen and, you know, and heard in my very limited experience about what localism is and can be. I'm kind of wondering, are there other aspects in this film of Point Break that you really dig, that you feel like they're nailing when it comes to surf culture and surf life at all? Or are there parts of this film that just kind of drive you nuts as a surfer and knowing what you know about the history of surfing? Are there goods and bads here? How do you feel about this film looking back on it now? Gosh, we're 32 years removed from this film.
Yeah, I'm getting old because I remember that when it was in the theaters.
I was in high school.
Yeah. I mean, there are things I like about it. Like with all movies, there are things that drive me crazy. But, you know, one thing that I think the film accurately captures is the willingness of surfers to do whatever is necessary in order to be able to subsidize their surfing habit. And that's ultimately what this film is about, right? Bodhi and his crew aren't robbing these banks in order to make tons of money. They're doing it so they can continue to surf, as well as skydive and do these other things too. But it's really ultimately, you know, surfing is at the center of this. And I think that's true for many surfers. Once you start surfing, you get the bug. I mean, you appreciate why it is that people center their lives around this pastime. It is really fun. It is something that, you know, surfers just absolutely love to do. And so they will make career choices. They'll make family choices. They'll make choices about where they're going to live, all based on their ability to surf. And I think Point Break pretty accurately captures that. I mean, this is, again, the Patrick Swayze character, Bodhi, you know, saying, I'm going to become an outlaw, a bank robber, so that we can continue to surf every year. And, you know, I think that speaks to the passion that people bring to this pastime.
All right. So one of the things you talk about in the book is the political nature of surfing. And say in 1991, I'm thinking specifically about apartheid in South Africa. You kind of made mention a little bit earlier to the Endless Summer and how they dodged that question entirely. Would Bodhi have surfed the breaks down in South Africa? And can you talk a little bit about the political nature of surfers themselves? I don't know that people would consider surfers to be political, but you argue that that's very much what they are.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I should say I tend to see everything through a political lens, right? And so I think even when people are choosing to be apolitical, or at least claiming to be apolitical, that's a political choice, right? You know, but certainly by the 1980s, 1990s, surfers were taking positions on political issues that inserted them into these political debates. For example, the debate over apartheid in South Africa. And so, you know, let me just step back and for a minute and say that, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar with surfing in South Africa, South Africa, outside of the United States and Australia, was probably, you know, up through the 1970s at least, the third major center of global surf culture. There were a number of very accomplished surfers, including a world champion by the name of Sean Thompson in the men's ranks, and in the women's ranks, a surfer by the name of Wendy Botha, who was a four-time world champion. You know, these were people who were very highly regarded surfers. South Africa, you know, again, was very much at the center of global surf culture. South Africa is home to some phenomenal waves, but surfing was centered, perhaps not surprisingly, within the white minority community in South Africa, which, you know, from the late 1940s up through the 1990s, maintained its rule through a violent system of racial separation known as apartheid. And surfers would often visit South Africa, but largely overlooked the issue of apartheid there, the fact that it was only whites who were really allowed to surf. I suppose, you know, black Africans and what were called coloreds in South Africa were able to surf as well, but beaches in the country were segregated. The beaches with the best waves were reserved for whites. When The Endless Summer featured in the 1960s, you know, the climax of that movie, it doesn't come at the end of the movie, but see, really the high point of that movie, the part that everybody recommends, is the part about South Africa. You know, this is a movie about a couple of California surfers who travel around the world following the summer looking for waves. And they find their best surf in South Africa at a place called Cape St. Francis, which Bruce Brown presented, the filmmaker presented, as this absolutely perfect surf break where waves broke every day, all year, every year. And, you know, I mean, I think as he put it in the fame in the film, you know, just imagine the waves that are going to waste right now at Cape St. Francis in South Africa. Now, this was, in fact, BS. Cape St. Francis, you know, it had some it had some very good waves when they were there, but it was very tide dependent and, you know, was not considered necessarily one of the great waves in South Africa. Very close to there is a place called Jeffreys Bay that is considered one of the greats. In fact, one of the greatest waves in the world, right? But that didn't feature in South Africa. And The Endless Summer, you know, this tremendously popular film, you know, set with these scenes in South Africa, never once mentions apartheid. And it's not because Bruce Brown didn't know about it. In fact, he did. You know, I've looked through the archival materials. He joked about it with others. And there is, in fact, a very subtle allusion to apartheid in the film that I think nobody picks up on unless they're looking for it. When I show this film to students, I always ask them, did you see any references to apartheid here? And none of them do. And then I point out and they say, ah. And this is a scene when the two Californians are surfing in Durban, South Africa, and it's a place where there are shark nets that exist. And at one point, you know, out in the water, suddenly some fins appear. And it turns out it's a group of dolphins. And Bruce Brown, you know, who's narrating this film, he's really the star of the film, even though he doesn't, well, very rarely appears on camera in the film, makes a joke about how well the shark nets are working, but also says something, you know, about how excited the surfers are to see the dolphins because they tend to keep the sharks away. And then there's this throwaway line in there, in which he says, sharks and dolphins have yet to integrate in South Africa. And that's clearly a reference to the racial reality of the country, the violent racial separation that existed there. But it's the closest the film ever comes to acknowledging that. So surfers, you know, they were aware of this, and surfers were in fact debating whether it was appropriate to go to South Africa and surf or not. In the late 1960s, for example, Surfer Magazine ran a piece on apartheid. Or, well, the piece was on South Africa, but there was a photograph that appeared in there that showed a young black African, South African man walking on the beach with three surfers in the background. And the caption for this photograph said, I can't remember precisely the wording, but something like, you know, he can only watch the surfers because in South Africa, beaches are segregated. And so that was all he was, in fact, able to do. And that photograph generated the most reader response in the history of Surfer Magazine. For months afterwards, people wrote in about apartheid, either saying, you know, how could South Africa be doing this? Or others writing in and saying, you know, first of all, racial separation is perfectly natural and normal. I mean, this is a time when, you know, racism was widely prevalent in not just South Africa, but in the United States. I mean, not that it's disappeared today, but it was much more openly discussed. And then others, of course, who were saying, you know, this has no place in Surfer Magazine. We ought not to be doing this. Surfing is supposed to be something that's free of politics. But what we saw early on is that surfing was starting to come to terms with the reality of South African apartheid and soon would have to come to terms with other elements of the politics of surf culture as well. By the 1980s, professional surfing, something really quite astounding happened. And that is the world's leading professional surfers, at least three of them initially, Tom Carroll, who immediately after winning his second world championship, he was an Australian surfer, won his second world championship at Bell's Beach in Australia, the same Bell's Beach that shows up at the end of Point Break, where Bodhi goes to surf the 50-year wave, wins this world championship at Bell's Beach, is interviewed on the beach afterward and asked about, you know, plans for the following year. And he says, well, I'm boycotting South Africa. I'm not going to surf in the contests in South Africa. and this sends shock waves through the surf community. He's immediately joined by a Californian by the name of Tom Curran, who would become a four-time surfing world champion, and another surfer named Martin Potter, who was considered one of the hottest surfers of the 1980s, particularly as an aerial surfer, who grew up in South Africa. He was actually a British national, but nevertheless grew up in South Africa. All three of them announced they were going to boycott South Africa. They were joined by another Australian named Shane Horan, who boycotted that first year, then returned to South Africa to compete with Free Mandela written on his surfboard. And that boycott grew so that by the late 1980s, 26 of the top 30 surfers in the world were not competing in South Africa. Now, most of them wouldn't say they were boycotting the country. They came up with other reasons for why they weren't participating in the contest there. But nevertheless, the message was quite clear. Surfers were not going to South Africa, and it was mostly over the apartheid issue. This was extraordinary, not because these athletes were doing this. Athletes around the world were boycotting South Africa, but what was different about surfing was that these were people who were not being ordered by their professional surfing league or organization to avoid surfing in South Africa. There, you don't have to make a personal choice. You know, if you're a cricketer and the Cricket Association tells you we're not competing in South Africa, well, the choice is made for you. In the case of surfing, you know, the ASP, which was the World Tour, what it was called at the time, not only did not boycott South Africa, but fined surfers who boycotted South Africa. And so these were surfers who not only lost out on the ratings points that they would win from contests in South Africa, the money that they would win by placing highly in these contests, but also had to pay fines for refusing to participate there for what they called humanitarian reasons. They tended not to see what they did in political terms. They, I think, tried to run away from this as political activism. You know, when I interviewed, especially Tom Carroll, Tom Curran, Martin Potter, they all spoke about this as really just taking a moral stand. I think they were a little uncomfortable with the idea of this being political, because I think they like to think of surfing as something that is apolitical. But it's hard not to see this in political terms. So would Bodhi have competed or would he have surfed in South Africa? I'm tempted to say no. Given that he saw surfing as, well, he's the sort of person who, despite being, you know, an outlaw willing to rob banks, nevertheless seemed to be driven by a bizarre moral compass that may have kept him out of the South African waters. Of course, the issue never came up, and so we don't actually know. And he's a fictional character, and so, you know, we're speculating about a fictional character here. But, you know, given that he was someone who identified as a soul surfer, and that soul surfers seem to not be in it for the money, the ratings, that sort of stuff, I like to think that perhaps he would have been someone who stayed away.
Yeah, I have to tell you that, you know, I had never thought about Bodhi in those contexts before. I mean, certainly he's a soul surfer, but that's part of the reason, part of the fun about reading your book was giving me all these new ways to think about the characters in this film. You know, so these questions about South Africa and all these other places and some of these other things. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the commodification of surfing as well. But you just kind of talked a little bit about talking to, like, you know, some of these surfers. And I'm kind of wondering, as you were writing this book and approaching surfers, these very high level surfers, were they open to talking to you? Like, how did that experience go? You say, hey, I'm writing a book on the history of surfing. I surf myself. Like, what is that dialogue like? Oh, you yourself were having to, like, now enter into this world of, like, trying to talk to these guys. What was that like? Were people open to you, and and did you have moments when you just couldn't get a hold of folks or people turning you down to talk?
Yeah, most of the folks I contacted were willing to speak with me. I mean, I was very fortunate. They were generous in sharing their time with me and opening up with me about, you know, these experiences that they had had as, in most cases, professional surfers. There were some I interviewed who weren't professional surfers. But, you know, in thinking about South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement, I interviewed those three that I mentioned, Carroll, Curran, and Potter. I also interviewed Sean Thompson, who was a South African surfer, the one I mentioned, a former world champion surfer, who was an opponent of the surfing boycott. And he was very generous in opening up with and sharing his ideas with me. And in fairness, I should point out, Sean Thompson is a very smart, very articulate person. and was not an apologist for apartheid at all. In fact, he was an opponent of apartheid. There was an incident in the 1970s when Eddie Aikau, who was a dark-skinned Hawaiian surfer, comes from a very well-renowned surfing family in Hawaii, the Aikaus. He won entrance into a South African surfing contest in 1972, given that he placed, I think, second in a contest in Hawaii. I don't think he fully understood or appreciated what he was getting into when he traveled to South Africa to compete there, and immediately faced problems. He got to his hotel. They wouldn't allow him to stay there. He realized he was going to have to be surfing on segregated beaches. The South African government got around this in this bizarre formulation where they endowed visiting surfers of color with, what they referred to as honorary whiteness so that they could surf on these segregated beaches. And the reason I mention this is it was Sean Thompson's family that actually took in Eddie Aikau and said, please stay with us when he was there in the 1970s. Sean Thompson, South African Jew, I think was very much driven by these deep moral convictions that he grew up with in the South African Jewish community that led him to oppose apartheid, but at the same time opposed the boycott movement because he felt that this was bringing politics into surfing in ways that were unhealthy and ill-advised, and raised questions that, frankly, could be difficult to answer. He said, sure, okay, if we boycott South Africa, do we boycott the United States? After all, I oppose what the United States is doing in sponsoring the Contras in Nicaragua. Where do we stop? Where does this end? I don't like what England is doing in Ireland. Do we boycott the UK? And, these are serious questions, and they're not easy to answer. And so he was raising these concerns. Ultimately, surfers did choose to boycott the country. But, his reason for that opposition, I tried to be very fair to this in my book, was I think, a very deeply considered and morally driven position about why surfers shouldn't boycott the country, why politics had no place in surfing. Now, I disagree with Thompson, both on the boycott issue, but also on the idea that surfing and politics not only shouldn't mix, but don't mix. I think, inevitably there's a politics of surfing. You can't help escaping this if you read my book. So I think Sean Thompson was wrong about that, but he is a very bright guy and he didn't blow these issues off. He thought a lot about them, thought very deeply about them.
I want to ask you about surf culture as far as the monetization of surf. I arrived here in Colorado about 4.5 months ago. I live in Pueblo, which is in the high desert. And for my day job, I work for the Forest Service, and I have to go out and visit these other towns and forests and things like that. And I have to tell you, I go to towns here in Colorado, and I go to surf shops. There are surf shops here in Colorado. There are surf shops, and we've seen them, Rip Curl, all these other places, in every suburban shopping mall in the United States. I can only imagine they exist elsewhere in the world. Can you talk a little bit about how we talk about this idea of surfing as this solitary pursuit of this inward understanding of yourself and connection to nature? And then at the same time, you have this massive explosion using the conception of surf to sell all this lifestyle apparel for people who will probably never ride on a board. Can you talk a little bit about where surf commodification happens?
Yeah, I mean, this is a phenomenon that really began developing in the 1970s, 1980s, especially. Surfing is today big business. I mean, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Quiksilver, one of the major surfwear brands, is a publicly traded corporation whose stocks appear on the New York Stock Exchange. It is big business. And this really began in the 1970s with the development of a professional surfing circuit, but especially escalated in the 1980s when you had these surf corporations that grew, tapping into this market of people who found surfing fascinating, found it cool, found it fashionable, and wanted to convey that through their sartorial choices, right? I mean, there's something about the surfwear that really appeals to people, the t-shirts, the shorts, the trunks, and so on. Surfers and these surfwear companies, these corporations that emerged, really began as efforts by surfers to subsidize their surfing habit. You know, we talk about Bodhi robbing banks to do this, right? Surfers in places like Australia and Southern California started backyard operations as board shapers, making board shorts, making wetsuits, and so on, in an effort to simply make enough money to be able to continue to surf. But these operations took off and they grew, particularly some of these Australian corporations, Quiksilver, Billabong, Rip Curl, all of these originated in Australia. And, you know, grew in Australia in the 1970s, 1980s, ultimately became American-based corporations. And they went there because, frankly, the United States was where the money was. The market was much larger in the United States. Capital existed much more abundantly. And these became U.S.-based corporations, many of them incorporating in Delaware, given its lax laws for corporate accountability. Quiksilver, for example, is incorporated in Delaware, which is hardly, you know, an American center of surf culture. So, you know, so they grew and grew into multi-billion dollar corporations and spread themselves all over the world. I mean, you mentioned seeing surf shops in Colorado. I've seen them in small cities in England. I've seen them in malls in Malaysia, running into a Quiksilver shop, you know, in the interior Southeast Asia is, you know, startling. It's not what one expects to see, but nevertheless, it exists. And I think that's because surfing has successfully tapped into this market of people who want to identify with what surfers see as the freedom associated with their pastime and certainly the coolness associated with their pastime. I mean, at its heart, surfing is about a person harnessing the energy of the natural world for pleasure. And surfers talk about this in terms of freedom. You know, they only feel free when they're out riding waves, and has become very closely identified with freedom in a world where it's difficult to find those sorts of outlets and to capture that sort of feeling. Moreover, there's a coolness associated with surfing. It kind of drives me crazy, but nevertheless is there, so that it's become something of a marketing lure. I mean, I think it's almost impossible today to watch a car commercial without seeing someone pulling a board out of the back of an SUV or making their way to the beach with a surfboard on the racks. Surfing is at the heart of this sort of rugged individualism that we often see in corporate marketing campaigns, and it's been very successful tapping into that. So this is a phenomenon that has really grown since the latter decades of the 20th century, despite the ironies at the heart of that. And the irony in particular that I'm thinking of here is that it's surfwear brands in particular that have been successful in emerging as these multi-billion dollar corporations, you know, with their marketing campaigns suggesting the freedom associated with this pastime, while at the same time relying on low-wage, exploited sweatshop workers in order to make these products. And so there's a really quite appalling irony at the center of this industry. It's an industry that taps into those ideas of freedom while at the same time, you know, showing unfreedom in the manufacture of its wares.
Thank you. I was really hoping to get into this duality of these ideas, these soul surfers versus this almost soulless companies. And, you know, and even the guys that I follow now, you know, guys like Kelly Slater's got his own surf company now, and Laird has his stuff, and Jerry Lopez is selling stuff, and it's wrestling with these. And then you've got guys like Rob Machado, who says he's a soul surfer, but he's sponsored to go and be a soul surfer. I mean, these guys are getting paid to do so, and, you know, people have the right to earn their living, and I'm not critiquing that, but there's definitely these dualities when it comes to the finances around this, and I don't know.
Absolutely.
I don't expect surfers to be monks. That's not fair to anybody, right? But investigating the commodification of this is absolutely fascinating to me. We talk a little bit. I just threw a whole bunch of names out of the audience they probably have never heard of before. And because it's ultimately a man or a woman on a board, on a wave, maybe we could talk a little bit about maybe some of the – I don't know, Scott, maybe – give me five or six surfers throughout time that we should know, and talk about their importance to the development of the pursuit. We'll call it the pursuit.
As a historian, I mean, I'm very interested in people who played important roles in the development of surfing. you know, certainly two Hawaiians that fit that bill are two names I mentioned earlier. One is Duke Kahanamoku, who is probably the best known historical figure in surfing today, you know, Hawaiian, who in addition to being a surfer was the world's fastest swimmer for a time. He broke world records in swimming. He competed in, I believe, 4 Olympic Games, if I'm not mistaken. Not all of them on the swim team. I think one he was on the water polo team exclusively as well. But I'd have to go back and check all of this. But someone who was, you know, a very accomplished and world-renowned figure, given his aquatic pursuits, especially as a swimmer, but also as a surfer. Duke, in fact, in 1914, 1915, traveled to various parts of the world, putting on swimming demonstrations, including to Australia, where at the same time he put on surfing demonstrations. And he wasn't the first person ever to surf in Australia, but really helped to popularize the pastime there and plant the seeds of Australian surf culture, which would emerge, you know, or which would sprout, you know, in extraordinary ways with Australia becoming, you know, a major center of surf culture. George Freeth is the other figure that I mentioned. George Freeth, who was also a Hawaiian, a mixed blood Hawaiian. His mother was Hawaiian. His father was not. He played a very important role, not just in spreading surfing to Southern California. He traveled to Southern California in the first decade of the 20th century, supported by what was called the Hawaiian Promotion Committee, which was basically an early version of the Hawaiian Tourism Bureau. He put on surfing demonstrations there, ultimately was hired by two major land developers who developed Venice Beach, Abbot Kinney, and then Redondo Beach, Huntington, who was a major developer, after whom Huntington Beach in Orange County is named. Anyhow, put on surfing demonstrations there, but also very importantly, helped to build and develop the lifeguarding service in Los Angeles and then later in San Diego, this professional lifeguarding service. This was at a time, you know, most people don't realize this, when most Americans were terrified of entering the ocean. And so the development of this lifeguarding service was meant to encourage people to feel more safe, more comfortable in seeing the ocean as a place of leisure rather than a place to be feared. Most Americans had at best rudimentary swimming skills at that time. And people like George Freeth, Duke Kahanamoku, helped to encourage then these early developments of surf culture in two places, California and Australia, that would prove enormously consequential for surfing history. Moving up to the mid-20th century, I actually think the surfer who inspired the Gidget character is someone people ought to be thinking that. That's a woman by the name of Kathy Koner. It was her father, Frederick, who wrote the novel Gidget that became a best-selling novel that inspired the movie for which he wrote the screenplay. This was a Columbia Pictures film, but he was the author of the screenplay. He was a screenwriter in Hollywood at the time. He was a Jewish emigre from Europe who had made his way to California, found work in Hollywood, and became very successful in that industry. And he wrote about Gidget based on the experiences of his daughter, Kathy, and her effort to break into the world of Malibu surfing in the 1950s. So a very notable figure, not just because she's a woman who helped to popularize the sport of surfing across the United States and spread this idea of surfing as a, you know, and its close association with California beach culture, but also just because she played a pivotal role more broadly in the popularization of surf culture in the 1950s and in the 1960s. You know, as we move into the late 20th century, I mean, it's hard to avoid names like Kelly Slater and Laird Hamilton. You know, Laird Hamilton is considered one of the major big wave surfers in the world. There's sort of a younger generation now that is picking up the example that he left. But, you know, someone who played a pivotal role in popularizing big wave surfing in the 1980s and the 1990s. And then, of course, I always appreciate him, maybe not, given his role in North Shore, where he played the character of Lance Burkhart, who's in many ways the embodiment of the competitive industrial surfer from the 1980s. And then Kelly Slater, who, you know, many people will refer to as the greatest surfer of all time. 11-time world surfing champion, just a phenomenal surfer. I don't like him because he's my age and he's in much better shape and surfs much better than I do.
He's from Florida.
And he's from Florida originally. That's right. Yeah. He's a Cocoa Beach kid, I think, in that area. But just a tremendously successful surfer, since we're on Historians at the Movies here, has you know, taken his shot at acting a couple of times. He had early roles in Baywatch, marginal roles, but nevertheless in Baywatch, and then was a voice actor in, was it Surf's Up? The animated
Surf's film? Up. He's self-credited. I think he and Rob Machado.
That's right.
Are both in Surf's Up, which we'll talk about in a second because I want to ask you about your favorite films. It's, God, I'm gonna ruin it. I love Surf's Up. It's a film, right? Oh my gosh. What about Surf Breaks, Scott? Are there Surf Breaks, like, you know, are there three or four when we talk, because there people talk about Surf Breaks like they're people. You see them often referred to with their own personalities. We were talking before we got going about how I'm excited to go see Mavericks, and Mavericks is always described as this hateful, angry place. Where are the Surf Breaks that we should know about? There are, that someone's listening to going, what's the Surf Break and why is this important? Why is this a spot? Where should we know?
Yeah, so that's a tough question because so much depends on what sort of surfing you're interested in doing. So if you're a big wave surfer, you know, what are the spots? Well, Mavericks in California certainly would be, you know, the premier spot probably in California. There's a couple of others, including a, you know, strange, scary sort of wave that breaks, you know, what, 100 miles off the coast of San Diego. God, I wouldn't surf Mavericks either. But, you know, these
to be sharks.
Terrifying waves. So if you're a big wave surfer, I mean, places like that are important. And then, of course, you know, in Portugal, you know, this has become sort of the place for the world's largest surfed waves at a break there called Nazaré. So, you know, that's an incredibly important place. And then, of course, in the Hawaiian Islands, you have big wave spots, Waimea Bay, Jaws, and so on. South Africa has its spots. And, you know, so if you're a big wave surfer, you know, those would be some of the big spots. But for, you know, most of us who are not big wave surfers, I mean, I look at these guys, I think they're crazy. But, you know, for the rest of us, what are the premier waves? So much depends on, you know, what you're willing to tolerate. I mean, most of the world's best waves are, you know, terribly crowded. And so the wave quality is outstanding, but the odds of getting some of those waves are not always high. And so, you know, a crappy break might end up being a better choice for you and a better wave in the end, because you actually get to ride some waves. But certainly some of the premier waves, I mean, you know, much will depend on whether you're what we call a regular foot or a goofy foot. Regular foot are surfers who put their left foot forward, goofy foot's their right foot forward. For me, I'm a regular foot. You know, I've never surfed there, but I've always wanted to surf Jeffreys Bay. I mean, I've looked at that wave in South Africa and thought, that just looks phenomenal. Maybe someday I'll get a chance to go there. I don't know. Certainly, you know, in California, I mean, the two breaks that I think of is just really quite world class are Malibu, which is, you know, an absolute zoo. So again, the odds of catching waves out there are really quite low, but the quality of the wave is really quite outstanding. The other is a place called Rincon, which is right on the Santa Barbara Ventura County line. Also a point break that just is, you know, when it's on, it is on. It's a phenomenal wave.
Yeah, I was just thinking you were talking about J-Bay, and I was thinking, was it at J-Bay? Who was it? Had the shark encounter?
Oh,
like, yeah, during the competition, a couple of years. Like, it was a terrifying event. He, who was it?
Oh, I'm drawing a blank. An Australian surfer, and
was
I
it Mick. No, it was
Mick Fannell, right?
Mick Fanning, right?
Yeah, Mick Fanning. Oh, yeah. Whatever. God, why am I drawing a blank on his?
It was
name?
Mick Fanning, right?
Yes, Mick Fanning. That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
For those of you who are listening, not being able to say Mick Fanning is like forgetting to say Mickey Mantle's name.
I know.
You know, it's like, you know, and both of them was like, you know, he's Australian. There's sharks down there, but there's sharks in South Africa. Either way. So, favorite films on or about surfing?
That's a tough one.
You talk about this in the book. We've talked a little bit about Big Wednesday. You know, there are a couple other spots that were in the book, but like, what do you got?
I do. Well, I do have a soft spot for Big Wednesday. I mean, I there is something, I still find it moving on a number of levels. You know, it's a movie about friendship, which I appreciate, and about surfing, bringing friends together. And, you know, given the way I grew up, it resonates with me. And so I do feel a particular fondness for that film. I do about The Endless Summer as well. I mean, that's a film I have watched hundreds of times. I remember I had a video cassette, you know, growing up, of The Endless Summer. I watched it until it couldn't be watched anymore. The cassette just ripped, and that was it. It was done. So that was a very important movie for me growing up. Certainly, you know, helped inspire my love for surfing and my desire to go travel and find places around the world where I might be able to ride waves. I also, you know, I don't actually like so much the film Gidget. You know, it's got its problems, but as a historian, I really appreciate it. I show this film to my students, and I think it's a really fascinating primary source in thinking about surf culture in the 1950s. And so I appreciate it for that reason. And then, of course, North Shore. It's hokey. It's terrible in all sorts of ways, but I love that film and I love watching it. So, you know, those would be a few of the films that I really do appreciate.
My favorite film in the world, Riding Giants.
Oh, Riding Giants. Yeah, it's a classic. Oh,
I get wistful every time Greg Knoll's on. Like, yeah. And he gets towards the end. And Greg, it's just like, you know, of course, he's passed a lot of the guys from Riding Giants. A lot of the older guys are gone now. I don't know if Pat Curran's still around. I think it's Tom's dad, right?
Yeah, I think he passed away just quite recently.
I thought so, right? And I'll tell you this, like, that film actually, when Laird is talking about his ride at Chopu, actually got me over my fear of flying. Because, you know, he's talking about this idea. He and his dad are talking. And he's like, it's like, I don't want to not live because I'm afraid of what could happen. And I was like, oh, there it is. That makes sense to me. And I always tell people, like, that line, quite literally, I used to be terrified of flying. And of course, in the film, you see people on these like turboprops going back and forth, you know, as they're landing in Hawaii in the 60s. But like, I used to be terrified. And it was quite literally that line that got me past it. What about books? This is a surf book. People interested in the history of surfing or other things that are, we got a reading crew that are listening to this pod. What should they be reading?
Yeah, this is a tough one. Both because there's a growing number of books, because if anybody who's written these books, and I know most of these guys is listening to this, I don't want to piss anyone off and not identifying their book.
I don't want Laird Hamilton mad at me. He'd kick my ass still. So yeah, go on.
Certainly, you know, in thinking about books, favorite books having to do with surfing, Matt Warshaw's The History of Surfing has to be up there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's an incredibly bold thing he did, writing a book called The History of Surfing rather than A History of Surfing. But if anybody can pull it off, I think he can. There is nobody on this planet who knows more about surfing and its history than Matt Warshaw. And it's just a beautiful book, too. It's a coffee table book. Warshaw is a great writer. He's very smart. And he's chosen beautiful photographs throughout this book. So I think it is, you know, that's certainly up there in terms of my favorite surfing books. And always reluctant to identify just a few books, but I will say a few that you know, I've been thinking about lately that I really appreciate. Isaiah Walker's book, Waves of Resistance, he's a Hawaiian historian, you know, is a very important book. And I think really just a wonderful book on a number of levels, both in restoring the importance of Hawaiians in the history of surfing, but also in addressing the gendered nature of surfing. Two other books I've been thinking a lot about lately that I really do like too. One is Patrick Moser's book on George Freeth. It's called Surf and Rescue. George Freeth is one of these underappreciated, but, you know, incredibly important figures in the history of surfing for reasons I've talked about, you know, already. Patrick Moser has done incredible work in uncovering sources that I didn't know exist, others haven't known existed, about George Freeth. I mean, I think he has scoured every local newspaper in Southern California looking for information about Freeth, and, you know, has really done yeoman's work in uncovering this material and has put together a really quite remarkable biography of him. It was published by the University of Illinois Press. Again, it's called Surf and Rescue. It's a great book. And then the last book I'll mention was written by a historian by the name of Steve Estes called Surfing the South. And I love this book. It's a work of creative nonfiction. I don't have much experience with the South. It's probably the United States, part of the United States I've spent the least amount of time in. But Steve Estes is a beautiful writer, and it's about a road trip that he took with his daughter through the South. She's a teenager. She's interested in surfing and learning to surf. Steve himself is a surfer. He grew up in the South in Florida, and he travels from the Gulf Coast up to the East Coast and spends time speaking with surfers in that area. And as a historian, trying to piece together local histories there. It's a beautifully written book, and it's very touching. I mean, it's part surf travelogue, part history of the South, but also part memoir of a father growing up with a teenage daughter. And as someone myself who has two teenage girls, I appreciated this. And I thought it was just it's just a really beautiful book.
I want to come back now to the film. Is there a most historic aspect of this? And when you think about this movie, is there a single spot that you remember most of all? If we had to say that this is the key point in the film that we remember, what do we got?
Well, this is probably going to be disappointed with this answer, but as a surfer, the thing that I remember most and that bothered me and probably most other surfers at the time is that it's Bell's Beach he identifies as the place that he's going to catch the 50-year wave, because Bell's Beach gets decent-sized surf, but it's not a big wave surf spot. And surfers just sort of, I suppose it was chosen because it has this exotic sort of sound to it, this place down in the cold Victorian coast of Australia. But Bell's Beach, I mean, it's a world-class wave, but it's not a big wave spot. So the idea that, Bodie would be heading there to catch, this thing called the 50-year wave, it just seemed improbable to me and bothered the hell out of me when the movie came out in 1991. And it's the thing that I probably remember most about it. Again, it's not, probably the best part of the film, but that's why I remember it, just because it just seemed, as a surfer, it drove me crazy.
Bodie's not wiping out in Australia. I'm sorry, that's not happening. Bodie's going to Portugal, or something like, I don't know. All right, last question. The big question here, Historians of the Movies podcast. Scott Latterman, surfer, historian. Is Point Break a history film?
I would say yes. I mean, it is, certainly I don't think Catherine Bigelow had in mind any ideas of making a historical film in doing this, but it does, I think, accurately capture that important moment in the development of surf culture, when surf culture had become industrialized, especially in the 1980s. And by the early 1990s, surfers such as Bodie trying to capture that pure element of surf culture. So in that way, I think it tells us something about that moment. And so, yes, I would say this is a historic film.
Awesome. I love it. Scott, where can people find you beyond the realms of this podcast?
Well, people are going to be disappointed. I'm a dinosaur when it comes to social media. I'm not on social media at all. But people can always drop me an email. My email is latterman@d.umn.edu. I like communicating with people the old fashioned way. Always happy to hear from people. But yeah, you're going to search high and low on social media. You're not going to find me there.
They can find you catching a wave up in Minnesota, up in Duluth.
I hope so.
Just don't try to drop in on you, I guess.
No, that's fine.
We'll find out what localism looks like in Minnesota. So awesome, man. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on here, Jason.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to Scott Latterman for coming on and talking about this movie, talking about this book. I had the best time talking to you, Scott. I can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you, of course, to our intrepid producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this show go. And, of course, most of all to you guys for coming in and listening in and sharing this podcast. The numbers continue to grow, and that's only because of you guys. So thank you so much. If you're really digging the pod, please do us a favor and leave a review, a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify Podcasts. And if you're interested in sponsoring the Historians of the Movies podcast, do reach out to us at historiansofthemovies@gmail.com, and we'll talk to you about that as well. So we've got a slew of other great pods coming up to you in 2024. Can't wait for you to hear them all. Thank you so much for being here. You guys are the best. Ciao for now.